Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I am your host, Joel Cherney. In 2012, George Lucas shocked the world when he sold Lucasfilm, including Star Wars, to the Disney Company. Even more, the news included the announcement of a sequel trilogy to the original films. In his book, Star Wars After Lucas, A Critical Guide to the Future of the Galaxy, Dan Golding describes the post-Lucas era, particularly seen through the eyes of The Force Awakens, Rogue One, The Last Jedi, and the animated Rebels series. In our conversation, we review many of the details from the book, including Dan's comparisons and reviews of the six previous films. Welcome, Dan Golding.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Joel. How are you?
Great. As we were talking about before the recording, you're in Australia, so you and I are pretty much, I think we said 14 hours apart. So it's my morning and you're very late evening. So I appreciate you taking the time. And you had mentioned that you were a late person. So that worked out perfectly for this.
I'm definitely a night owl, yeah.
So we're going to be talking about your book, Star Wars After Lucas, which is soon A Critical Guide to the Future of the Galaxy. One of the things that I found interesting when I looked and said I really wanted to talk to you is that I first started doing these podcasts in September of 2014. And at that point, the first person I ever talked to was Chris Taylor about his book, How Star Wars Conquered the Universe.
Oh, perfect.
And given that you use Chris, you know, you do quote from his book a number of times in the in your book, I found it very interesting. I says, well, this is nice. I mean, not that I'm stopping this anytime soon, so it's not a bookend, but it tells me that at least it's a subject that I'm well versed at.
No, absolutely. I mean, I actually haven't been in direct contact with Chris, but I mean, I loved his book. And in some ways, I sort of feel like, and you know, not to tread on his toes if he ever writes a follow-up, but I feel like my book is in some ways a spiritual successor to his. And I thought that while I was writing it. So that's perfect.
Well, given that I've read both of them, I think they're the difference is you do actually, yours published to an academic press and his was more quote-unquote popular, but still they both took a very almost academic view, but in a good way at Star Wars. I know there are academic treatises on Star Wars out there, but sometimes you want something that's still also readable to the general public, and yours is definitely that.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I'm pleased to hear that. That was definitely the hope, yeah.
So before we get to in detail about this book, let's talk a little bit about your background. Obviously, you not only are a professor, is that the right? I'm not sure of the term in Australia, so you can welcome to correct me. Yeah. But so talk a little bit about your education and your educational work.
Yeah, so in Australia, it's funny you should mention that. So a professor is like a level of seniority above me. I guess my title is senior lecturer, but that would be professor in American terms. But in Australia, to call someone professor means they're sort of 20, 25 years into a career. So I get a promotion every time I speak to an American, which is nice. But my background is, yes, so I'm an academic. And at the moment, yeah, I teach a lot of media studies and film studies and music, but from a media perspective, so more as an industry rather than, you know, the musicological sort of theory or anything like that. That's not quite what I do. But how I got to this point is sort of a really mixed bag. My PhD was on video games and video games as media, so a reasonably different area, but that was as part of a kind of a film department. So very much still, you know, learning the ropes in a similar kind of context. But I've done a lot of journalism. I've done a lot of work for the ABC, which is the national broadcaster here in Australia. That's the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, and not the ABC in America. You know, so anything from the written word, I've done a lot of that. I've also done quite a lot of radio. At the moment, I host the film music show, which goes live nationally every Saturday around Australia. So that, I mean, is a huge dream for me. I only started doing that this year, and you know, I just love doing that. So really, you know, I guess I come to Star Wars from a whole bunch of different perspectives, really, and no one sort of discipline or particular set of experiences informing my approach.
I hope people reach out, because the ABC is available to listen to on the internet for people outside. Well, it's digital anyway, but I mean, anybody can listen to it over the web, or at least in the United States, I assume other countries as well. And your show is available on the web, so hopefully people who have interest in film music will reach out and listen. I found ABC Classic is the name of the station, station, and it's classic as in classical, basically. But nicely, you include film music, and that's great, because I really believe, especially with, I mean, Star Wars to a large extent brought back film scores to me. Yeah. I mean, I know other movies have used them before that, but Star Wars really made the big difference and change as far as that's concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. In 1977, I mean, John Williams had big success with Jaws in 75, but, you know, really Star Wars was the one that just transformed the industry back towards orchestral scores, which had sort of faded in the 60s towards the trend towards like tracked music and pop music and stuff like that as well, which, you know, I think also works brilliantly. But I mean, my heart, it lies with orchestral, sort of the old golden age Hollywood sound. So, you know, Star Wars really, as you say, revived that to a huge degree. Actually, yes, sorry, I should have mentioned as well, I do a film music podcast, The Art of the Score, with two other guys, one who works at a symphony orchestra here in Melbourne and the other who travels the world, frequently going to America, actually, to conduct film scores, the live in concert performances that are so popular these days. That's such a pleasure to do that podcast.
Yeah, I know we were talking about film music. I obviously The Godfather in 72 and then the sequel, music was very important to those films. But I also have memory of China Syndrome, which I think came out in 79, maybe the year's wrong. It has a pop song at the beginning for the title, for the titles, and then there's not another note of music in the rest of the film. Except maybe for news, you know, a news theme or something, one note of music in the rest of the film. And I think it's interesting. It was not 79. It's even earlier than that. But anyway, it was before Star Wars. So anyway, music, I appreciate your knowledge of music, because I think it really does help. Star Wars hits people. I know I remember buying the soundtracks and everything. Of course, I'm a little older than you. I actually was 21 when the first Star Wars came out. And oh, you state in the book that you weren't even born yet. So
I wasn't, but I'm jealous, really. I would have loved to have been able to go and see the first film of, you know, just Star Wars. I won't even say A New Hope, just Star Wars, which is what it was.
It was a big shock when, I mean, obviously, when the first film came out, nobody knew what to expect. It hadn't gotten huge amounts of I mean, the publicity was there, but by the time I saw it on a Saturday night in a multiplex, which were around in 77 with a packed theater, and this was I think it was September, so the movie had already been out for a while, and not knowing what to expect, seen a couple of trailers, but nothing specific, so I went into it pretty much blind and walked out and I said, I don't believe it. And then when they added the New Hope, the Latin, you know, when they did a re-release with the New Hope, everybody said, what does this mean? And pre-internet days. So obviously there was a lot of discussion of what was going on. And when the New Hope was added on it, it made the new Time Magazine mentioned it and a few other places. So it was an interesting time, especially, like I say, pre-internet. And in the same way when Empire came out and so on. But the prequels, by the time the prequels came out, internet wasn't really a big deal yet, but places like AOL was around and, you know, Prodigy and a few of these other services, so people could talk about them.
Yeah, definitely. I did a lot of that. I was definitely around by the time the prequels came out and was already very much a Star Wars fan by that point in time. I think I figured it out the other day. I would have been 12 when The Phantom Menace came out. I remember distinctly, and I've actually just been writing about this recently because the direct callback in the Rise of Skywalker trailer, but seeing those first words in the first teaser for The Phantom Menace of every generation has a legacy, and that was just so powerful. Not legacy. And
we'll talk about legacy in a few minutes.
Yeah, that's a big word for you. I'm getting ahead of myself. But yeah, you know, download. I mean, this is on a 56K modem in reasonably rural Australia at that point. So I had, you know, a new 5 or 10 second snippet of that trailer to watch every 10 minutes and sort of spent the evening downloading the trailer and reflecting on it.
And of course, the first trailer didn't even give a title of the film yet. It was just episode one, and they did not. It was the same thing where the titles did not get put out right away. And in fact, I was the new movie, you know, episode nine or nine. That I was a little shocked that they included the name of the film right away, because sometimes they'll wait till the full trailer before they put the title on. But anyway.
Mm.
But yeah, watching the new trailer, there's no question you can see so much of the callback, and we talk about legacy in a minute, but I mean, there's so much legacy in that. And between Lando Calrissian being in the trailer and then his laugh and then having the Emperor's laugh at the end, it was like, okay, I think we're making the point here.
But, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, J.J. Abrams has, you know, his sort of line in so many of the interviews, well, the few interviews that he's given about this film so far, has really been emphasizing how he sees it as the final film in a 9-film collection, but also kind of the final film in a sequel trilogy. So it's, you know, I think they're very conscious of having to balance two separate kind of endpoints. So I wonder whether there will be, perhaps more than we've seen in the previous films, a little bit more acknowledgement that we're also wrapping up the prequels as well as the original films and the sequel trilogy, which is a lot less controversial to some viewers.
Although I agree with you when in some of what you talk about the prequel, that I think the story, parts of the story of the prequels are quite good. I really enjoyed much of the story. The problem was where most people's complaints were with the execution. And I think there were a couple spots that mostly casting, but, you know, we could have seen completely different movies. But anyway, that's the way we're... Yeah, I remember when the prequels came out, especially after the third one came out, you could see the 6 movies being really more the story of Anakin Skywalker as opposed to, you know, from beginning to end, where it will be interesting to see how we look at the full 9 from start to finish and what kind of arc of a story we pull out of it when the final one comes out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this is something that, I mean, I think has slowly been becoming clear to the makers of these films, even George Lucas. I mean, I don't think it's indisputable at all that he knew that Darth Vader was in fact Anakin Skywalker when he was making the first film. I think probably in all likelihood he thought they were two different characters and later sort of merged them together in Empire, you know, in a brilliant move, but not necessarily a pre-planned move. So when you're thinking of that original film, I mean, Anakin Skywalker is really just a myth, a legend, a person who's mentioned really once or twice, I think once by name. So it's, it has ebbed and flowed and evolved and become something you know, really on its own terms by film number 9, and we'll see where that ends up.
Right, and the name Anakin doesn't appear in original trilogy until Return of the Jedi. Mm. It's the first time you hear the name Anakin. So I think I'm pretty because I know it wasn't mentioned in any of the other films. So, but yeah, you're right. I think Lucas has done a great job of creating a legend of his own in which he wants people to sort of think that he wrote all 6 movies at one time and decided to start with 4. And people have done, there's a couple of books out there, especially Secret History of Star Wars is one I can think of, where the person, the writer actually went back and reviewed all the scripts that he could get his hands on and stuff and as much information as he could. And I think you're probably right. I mean, most of what Lucas did was, okay, this is a movie. It's done. And then things built up, the legend built from there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and sort of kept piling on and piling on. And I mean, Lucas to me is a fascinating character. I mean, the book is called Star Wars After Lucas, right. But you know, I think you can still, there's so much to be gleaned from, I mean, his very limited public comments about the new films and the new era, but also, you know, just how he saw his films. And he's always acted throughout his career, really, from 1976, even before the first Star Wars film was released. He gave an interview where he more or less acts like this has been a massive inconvenience making this film, and he cannot wait to get back to making what he calls his small, independent, experimental
films. Yeah, you know, he mentions that has been his regular mantra for his entire career, and yet we haven't seen a single small, independent film from him.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the only really thing, I mean, he produced, I think, Red Tails after Revenge of the Sith, and that's really the only non-Star Wars thing he's made in a very long time. And even then, you know, of course, he didn't direct it. I mean, Lucas seemingly hates directing films. He likes being involved in the creative process, but actually being on set directing actors seems to dislike that quite significantly. So
there was another thing that could have made the first 3 films better had he gone with that.
Yeah.
Maybe we would have had slight improvement there too.
But therein lies the sort of contradiction and why I think he's so fascinating, because, you know, it would have been the easiest thing in the world to go, okay, you know, I've got the huge pile of cash and I'm going to find a creative person, a director or a writer, whoever, to make this job easier for me and to kind of step back. He could have done that, you know, right from the moment Star Wars was an assured success. But and, you know, of course, he got Irvin Kershner to direct Empire Strikes Back and Richard Marquand to direct Return of the Jedi, though it seems like perhaps Jedi was directed a little bit from afar by Lucas to some degree.
I think he learned a little bit from the Kershner experiment, which I still think was the greatest experiment. And had he gone with that going forward, things would have been much different. I still consider Empire to be the best movie of them all. And the reason I think it's so great is because we had a real director who had total control, pretty much or seemingly total control of the actual filming, and clearly knew what he was doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I agree pretty much holistically. Yeah. And I mean, you know, but it is fascinating. Like, why didn't he do that for the prequels? If he had such a bad time and he didn't enjoy directing so much, then, you know, he could have given it to somebody else. And so the fascination for me is, well, why not then?
Well, I think it's the paradox of Lucas. He says he doesn't want to, he finds certain things to be not to his liking, but I also don't think he wants to give up control. I think that was probably one of the most interesting things about the sale was, and now we'll get more into what your book is about. The sale was that he gave it up lock, stock, and barrel. Nothing. Mm. He has no control over anything going forward, and he just sold it outright, and that was it.
Yeah, sort of seemingly his retirement plan. But, you know, I mean, you're talking about control. I mean, in the sale process, it seems like he, you know, very much tried to have his fingerprints over every stage of the process, you know, wrote these script treatments or, you know, partially commissioned these script treatments for the sequel trilogy, I think partly to sweeten the deal, to sort of make it seem like, you know, episode 7, 8, and 9, more Star Wars was you know, sort of anointed, authorized for Disney to take up. But at the same time, you know, really, you know, having his story be continued, which is very different to interviews that he was giving even in the immediate years before the sale, where he sort of suggested that, you know, he'd even perhaps altered his will. So if he, you know, up and died in 2010, then nobody could make any more Star Wars ever. Because his will would preclude it. So, you know, and of course, you know, choosing Kathy Kennedy, for example, to take over the day-to-day running of Lucasfilm. I mean, that was, I think people today sometimes make the mistake of just assuming she's kind of a Disney appointment, but she wasn't. No. So, you know, very much I think he's still... the George Lucas signature is still definitely part of that company.
Yeah, Kathleen Kennedy, the first I remember of her is the Indiana Jones movies, where she was a co-producer with Frank Marshall, who happens to be her husband, but he's a decent filmmaker all by himself.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I mean, Kathleen Kennedy's been around for a long time, both with Lucas and Spielberg and others. So she, when I heard she was taking over, there was no question in my mind that that was a good thing. And as you point out in the book, Disney's been pretty good about purchasing, when they purchased it, they've let those filmmakers pretty much do what, you know, keep things like you mentioned Pixar, and definitely with Marvel. I mean, there's no sign of any real Disney-fying going on in the Marvel films that I can see.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think it's interesting as well today, given, you know, the sort of storied history that these new films now have and the central place that they have in popular culture. It's very easy to forget that in 2012, when the sale of Lucasfilm was announced to Disney, people went bananas. You know, it was like the world was ending. There was, you know, I think I can't quite remember the news story, but I think it was possibly like The Onion or somebody made a pretty off-color joke, I think, about how it was the worst disaster of the week, and there'd been a tornado or something like that, which had killed actual people. And they were sort of making the joke that, hey, this is even worse than that. And, you know, people sort of, you know, thinking that Star Wars would be, you know, musical films with Mickey Mouse ears and, you know, just kind of totally forgetting that actually Disney has operated under a siloed model for a while now with those two companies, particularly with Marvel and Pixar. Yeah.
Well, I remember the story, and I don't remember. I was 2012. Who knows? I know I was home, wherever home was at the time. And I do remember the TV was on, and I don't know if I saw it on the internet first, or, you know, or saw it as actual story on TV that was on, and I was flabbergasted. And at first, I had to think. My first thought was, I'm not sure what this means. And the more I thought about it, I said, well, wait a minute. And I think it was knowing Kathleen Kennedy's name, since she was mentioned right at the top. I says, okay, well, wait a minute here. Let's see what happens. This certainly sounds like you've got somebody putting in here who's not just going to be a, you know, who has ties to Lucas. So it's not just some total stranger that they brought in off the street, so to speak, to do this. So I'm sure I said, let's wait and see. But the concept of more Star Wars was certainly a positive as far as that was concerned.
Yeah. I mean, I remember being really surprised and kind of, you know, curious to see what the future would hold. But I certainly didn't think that The Force Awakens, well, being episode 7, would turn out anywhere near as well as it did. And I know that some people perhaps might think that to be a controversial opinion, but I still think The Force Awakens is a, like a tremendous success in many ways. But look, you know, we're back at that moment, I think I was perhaps optimistically skeptical, if that makes sense, and that I was hoping that it would turn out okay. But, you know, keeping my my hopes to myself. And of course, you know, there was that whole clearing out of the extended universe well, because
that sort of certain fans, I mean, that was the one that sort of got me, was when people started complaining about the fact that the extended universe was gone. And I said, well, what's wrong with that? They're books. I mean, it's like Star Trek did the same thing. I mean, they had their extended universe in Star Trek, and nobody ever made a film of any of the Star Trek books. So why would we assume that these would be the same? I mean, you can keep your prequel stuff as much as you want, because nobody's going to touch the prequels again. But you can't tie a filmmaker to say, well, you've got to have this character and this character. And so
it doesn't make a lot of sense in retrospect to sort of imagine that Disney's going to, I mean, you know, people were sort of like, maybe they would, you know, 7, 8, 9 are going to be direct adaptations of Timothy Zahn's right. Thrawn trilogy, which were the, you know, the hugely successful books right. that were really, I think, the first authorized, major authorized fiction works in the 1990s, I think it was.
Right. There were a number of books that came out at the time of the original Star Wars, including Splinter of the Mind's Eye, which came out between the films and completely destroyed the storyline in comparison.
Yeah.
But you're right. There were some books, but then they all once again took a break, and then suddenly Timothy Zahn's book started it all over again, which there definitely saw improvements of what we were getting as far as fiction was concerned.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, look, I love those books as much as many people. I mean, you know, even with the, I think there's a lot of cloning going on in those novels and some pretty kooky storylines. But, you know, Thrawn is a great character, and I'm really glad he's been brought back into the sort of Star Wars canon now with the animated series Rebels.
The books, too. I mean, they do new Thrawn books, so that's great, too. If people like them, now they actually get to see him on screen, so to speak, even if it's a TV screen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And an upcoming radio play as well, I think. Well, sort of, you know, whatever we call a radio play these days, an audio drama, I think.
Audio drama, right.
I
still have the recordings of the Star Wars, the original Star Wars BBC audio dramas where they added all kinds of extra information in them, mostly taken from the books. But it was something additional. And I think back then, those of us who were into the trilogies, we wanted a trilogy. Yeah. We wanted to know, okay, give us more. Unfortunately, that meant Marvel put in a space bunny in the comic book. So that's where things sort of went awry.
Right. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that, which I suppose with the ownership agreements means that character could easily be revived today in canon if they wanted to. But, you know, I'm sure they won't. But I loved those audio dramas, the ones with Mark Hamill in the cast. I listened to them probably as much as I watched the films as a kid. So they are very, very much part of my own Star Wars love.
And they're easily available. Audible still sells them, at least in the United States. So if anybody wants to hear the old radio dramas, they're easily still available to people to listen to, and they're definitely worth it.
Definitely, yeah.
So let's get into the book, though, because I know we've been sort of dancing around it, but I think it's a good introduction. I mean, we've gone 26 minutes and we haven't really talked the book that much, but I think it all talks. It's all the book.
There's always so much to talk about with Star Wars.
When in your mind did you decide that this was a book you wanted to do?
That is a really good question. I'd written a few responses to the new, not even the new films, actually. It was to do with the marketing campaign for The Force Awakens, those first few trailers. I'd written a few pieces, and I basically just emailed a friend of mine, because I mentioned that I had a background in games journalism, and so I knew an editor of Kotaku, the sort of major games website, and they have an Australian company, I suppose, a sub-publication, and a friend of mine edited the local version of that, and I sort of messaged him one day and said, oh, look, do you, you know, if I wrote something about Star Wars, would you publish it? And he was really, really kind and encouraging, published basically the first thing that I wrote and popped it up, it really did pretty well, I think. It was really quite widely read as a reaction and an analysis of that first trailer, and not the first trailer actually, because the first trailer was in 2014, which is just a very brief one. It's that one that ends with Kylo Ren with the lightsaber, the double hilt shown off for the first time. This was the the Luke dialogue over the top from Return of the Jedi, or a similar dialogue to that, and the end with the Chewie We're Home.
I still remember watching the day that came out, because I know they premiered it at a Star Wars celebration, I think, or a Disney
thing. Yeah.
And I remember watching it on the web right after it premiered, or actually I think I was watching it live, because they were simulcasting it live. And when they played that trailer and you started to see things you recognized, and then got to the end there.
Yeah.
No one who had any interest in Star Wars could not feel something when they saw that.
Isn't it so powerful? I rewatched it even just, I think, I think literally yesterday I rewatched it, and it still has such an emotional effect on me. And I remember, I because, you know, we've already mentioned the time difference. And so it was about the panel for that event began at about 2 a.m. And as I said, I'm a night owl. So I happened to be up writing anyway. I was just doing a bit of other sort of academic work. And I sort of thought, oh, you know, Celebration's on. I think they're going to do some stuff about the new film. I wasn't that interested in that first trailer with the reveal of Kylo Ren. It looked interesting, but not really sure about the idea of new Star Wars. I'll just pop the panel on and see what's happening. And I remember sort of gradually being slowly more and more interested in that. And then finally they played that trailer at the end. And I just remember crying with especially that line at the end. But there's also a moment about, I think it's about 20 seconds into the trailer, where they play some of John Williams' music from the original trilogy. And they cut to that shot of Poe just sort of whooping, I suppose you describe it,
right,
in the X-Wing. And that to me was like,
right,
the kind of optimistic, adventurous, and joyous Star Wars, the kind of fun,
right,
that was, you know, for the better or worse, you know, all when all is said and done about the prequels, I think fun was not always there in that same kind of way. I was kind of like, wow, okay, just seeing somebody kind of cry out with joy while they're flying an X-Wing, I think I might be having a response here. But yes, then I went on to write about how, gosh, you know, that first shot of that trailer is Rey riding across the landscape, the horizon in her speeder past the fallen Star Destroyer and the next wing in the foreground, and sort of how, as a first shot in that trailer, I mean, that just, I think it shows just how expertly, not just the film was pitched, but the marketing campaign was pitched, in that it allowed the audience to mark the passing of time, to sort of be welcomed back into the universe, but also to acknowledge that, you know, things have changed, and you might want to learn how things have changed since you last were here, you know, before the credits of Return of the Jedi. And, you know, that shot, as well as I argue in the book, and argued at the time, actually kind of mimics the very first shot of the very first Star Wars film, where we see a Star Destroyer flying overhead, following the logo and the credits that we've just seen, you know, hotly pursuing the rebel blockade runner, Princess Leia's blockade runner, and how, you know, so many people over the years have written about how that shot kind of spoke to something larger in the universe to them, and kind of, you know, gave them a sense of some incredibly poignant, or like almost pregnant possibility of this world that they had to learn more, and that they kind of, you know, felt themselves being pulled in after the Star Destroyer into this universe where the kind of boundaries of the theater and the image of the film blurred. And, you know, I think that's such a great way of thinking about those original films and what they did for a lot of people at the time. And so to see that shot, because the camera, instead of staying static as it is in that original shot, and the ships are moving, well, the ships are downed on Jakku, and the camera is moving, but it still is similar in that we see a kind of an X-Wing, so not quite a blockade runner, but it's a rebel ship, and then followed by the downed Star Destroyer. And so it's sort of like we're seeing the same thing. We're being welcomed in the same way, but the rules have changed. They've literally been put into a new direction. And I just, you know, I just think that was so, so powerful, actually, and quite smart, too.
Well, this is probably where Disney is at its finest, and that is marketing. So,
yeah,
there's no question. But I mean, J.J. Abrams is too. I mean, like I say, we've seen so much from him, and the fact, and at the time when he was announced that he was going to take the reins, that everybody had, he had done a reboot of Star Trek, and
yeah.
In a way, he rebooted Star Wars, even though it was more of a continuation, as where with his reboot of Star Trek, he had to pretty much start all over, which he did by bringing back Spock from the past, but then eventually rebooting everything, where in Star Wars, he still had to continue on with what we had. I mean, he wasn't going to start it all over or anything like that.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Look, you know, Star Trek I really like Star Trek as well, and I like his Star Trek. Well, I certainly really like the first one.
Right.
He was kind of training in a way for Star Wars. But I think especially at the time, people made jokes about, there'd be lens flares everywhere, and because that was kind of his directorial trademark, especially with the Star Trek films. There are admittedly a lot of lens flares, especially, in any shot on the bridge in those films. But, if you look at the other films that he's done, he's following, I think, similar preoccupations. Even Mission Impossible 3 has that extended sequence towards the end where Ethan Hunt trains his wife to sort of revive him in a way, but he's transferring skills in a desperate kind of situation. He's training her to survive on her own, which is what we see a lot of in these kind of franchise revival films, these legacy films. And as well with Super 8, which I think is a really underrated film that Abrams made. It's not reviving any specific franchise at all, but it is very clearly talked about by Abrams as a extended homage to basically the films of Amblin Entertainment, but things like E.T. and The Goonies. And so, he spent a career as a director, and of course, as a writer and a producer, his career dates back to the 90s. But, as a director, as a film director, in those sort of 5 years in the lead up to The Force Awakens, he's doing similar things. He's working within nostalgia, within memory, but also films that are about training, about ensuring people survive after you're gone.
And I did rewatch in preparation for this, and as I was reading the book, I did rewatch Force Awakens 2 days ago and then The Last Jedi yesterday, mostly because it's been a while since I'd seen either of them. I wanted to get a sense. And I will tell you this, as somebody who obviously has been around with Star Wars my entire adult life, one of the things I noticed immediately with rewatching Force Awakens, there's two things. Number one, right at the very beginning, you knew we were on real sets. Now, granted, obviously, there were a lot of ships and stuff, so there were ways that we had to, we still had a lot of CGI and visual effects, but the bottom line is you knew you were in a real world. Those scenes of of Jakku early on, where you're clear, they're in the desert. They're not on some green screen, with a green screen behind them. So you saw a definite difference to the prequel and then the prequels. And then the other thing was the minute Han Solo appears in the film, the humor level goes up crazily. It's just unbelievable how much more the minute he's there. Not that there isn't a little bit before then, but once he's there, the whole thing lightens. And I think that was one of the other great things with The Force Awakens.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. J.J. Abrams as well spoke about getting a performance out of Harrison Ford that avoided his sort of the growly, gravelly Harrison Ford that had perhaps been a factor of his films for the previous decade, where he, quite literally his voice is just pitched lower in a lot of his other films as he got older. And so, getting him to kind of raise his voice a little bit and even, just sort of break out of his shell and be a little bit closer to that kind of, that fun, that sort of course, everybody goes to the brilliant moment in the first film where he shoots the console saying, boring conversation anyway, and that entire sort of, seat of your pants kind of making it up as you're going along, which in some ways is similar to Indiana Jones, at least that first film. That's also, I think, that's the real mood of The Force Awakens, which is, I think, beyond any plot similarity or the way that people were like, it's just a remake of A New Hope. The thing to me that is actually most similar to the original trilogy and actually most similar to A New Hope is the way that The Force Awakens, it just feels breathless. It feels lightning fast. It's just, there's constantly something happening. And when our heroes escape one scene, they sort of get to relax for about 5 seconds before the next crisis comes along, and they've got to sort of make it up as they go along and find their way out of it. But there's this kind of it's like a roller coaster in that sense, although today with today's eyes going back and watching A New Hope, especially some sequences on Tatooine by today's standards are quite low. I think back then, I mean, it felt lightning fast, I think.
It was great filmmaking. You had the craziness going on up at the ship. You needed a pause. And you know, that's the part where Lucas, there's no question that his pacing to a large extent, I mean, he had his pauses in there. So you had your moments of breathing, at least, so that you weren't nonstop, which unfortunately these days it seems like some movies, they don't believe in pausing, you know. And Lucas, that's one thing I will give for Lucas. He understands the importance of pauses.
Yeah, absolutely. But as well, I mean, you know, I mean, he himself has, you know, self-deprecatingly joked that his directorial style is to basically only say, okay, do it again, but this time faster and more intense. And, you know, I think, but, you know, it's not a bad contribution to cinema. I think Lucas has many contributions to cinema and even directorial style beyond what we might think of, like, perhaps special effects or world building or stuff like that. But, you know, as a kind of mood, I think the pace of A New Hope is great. And I think The Force Awakens does a really terrific job of evoking that sense of positive breathlessness.
You mentioned Harrison Ford, and I still remember my favorite Harrison Ford scene in any movie he's ever made, and unfortunately in the original version it was cut, and that's in American Graffiti, where he sits in his car, and we've been given this idea of who he is and who he was in that film, and he's sitting there singing Some Enchanted Evening. And that scene originally got cut when the film first came out, and Lucas was able to put it back in, and there's you just sit there and you start laughing, because you see, that's, you want to think that's really Harrison Ford there. I mean, that's just, it's he's a real character there. So I also laughed that the day's going to come where Harrison Ford's going to be in a movie and he's going to say, "Get off of my lawn." There's something like that has got to be coming at some point.
Yeah. I mean, look, I would not be opposed to a sequel to Air Force One. I think that's a underrated Harrison Ford film from the 90s. Not super smart, but lots of fun.
So anyway, let's like I say, we keep talking about the books and going off into tangents, but that's the way as you pointed out, that's the way Star Wars is. So your book covers, you obviously had to decide, okay, this is the areas I wanted to cover. So in addition to the, you know, the actual, some background information about the trilogy, the original trilogy and the prequels, and then the Disney sale, you basically concentrate on The Force Awakens, Rogue One, Last Jedi, and then the Rebels animated series. Those are your focus. Obviously, you know, before the book came out, Solo came out, but you had to put a stop someplace. And frankly, you know, that was probably a good way to do it. But those were the things you focused on. But one of the things I wanted to bring up, because it is so important both to your book and other things you've made, is the concept of legacy films. And if you could talk a little bit what you mean by legacy films, because I know it's very important, not only for this film, for these films, but for other films as well.
Yeah. So this concept of the legacy film, I mean, I'm not the only person in the world to have thought of this idea. It previously was coined by a journalist called Matt Singer, wrote about this idea of the legacy-quel, I think I'm going to pronounce it as. I'm not quite sure. It's all one word, so it's a neologism, a portmanteau. But legacy-quel or legacy-quel, I don't know quite how. I mean, I think it's perhaps up to the speaker to choose how to say it. But so I just called it a legacy film because it's easier. But this idea of these films, which I think, gosh, you know, like a lot of people will recognize these types of films, even if they haven't quite given them a name. But films like The Force Awakens, films like Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull, or Independence Day Resurgence, or Creed, or to some extent Blade Runner 2049, or, you know, the Abrams Star Trek films, or Tron Legacy, where essentially they're about reviving a dormant franchise that was popular and transferring it to a new generation of stars or characters, and also really to a new generation of audience members as well. which is interesting because especially in the case of Star Wars, this kind of intergenerational transference is something that has always happened. And Carrie Fisher, in her fantastic memoirs, The Princess Diarist, writes pretty perceptively about how fans would come up to her at conventions or events and sort of say, like, you know, hey, I've brought my six-year-old daughter and I've just started showing her Star Wars, or, you know, the other end of the spectrum where maybe, you know, a 25-year-old might come up to her and say, oh, my dad, you know, used to, you know, sit down with me and watching Star Wars was the thing that we did, right? So it's something that people have always done, but now the films do that as well, in this kind of, you know, this moment where you might be able to take, I don't know, dad or whatever to go and see the new Star Wars film, but it's because you're interested in it as well, and there's something for both generations. So it kind of works on multiple levels, obviously the in-film narrative level, but also the kind of, you know, the industrial but also cultural level, I think. And so, you know, there are so many, I mean, I mentioned quite a few of these films, and they broadly speaking have a few familiar beats, I think, to a lot of them, in that, you know, they'll all usually have legacy characters, which is actually that's not my term, that's the term that Kathleen Kennedy uses for the original trilogy characters in the sequel films. She calls them legacy characters, but then there's, you know, the sequel characters, your Rey, your Finn, your Poe, etc. And the film is kind of, you know, narratively then about, well, how do we reach the point by the end of the film where we've kind of transferred the future of the franchise to these younger characters, but kind of authorized that transfer? And often that's by having these older characters turn up a bit cynical, perhaps a bit jaded. They've already done, you know, the hero thing, and they've moved on, you know, like Rocky in Creed, he just wants to run his restaurant. You know, Harrison Ford says, you know, I used to be Han Solo in The Force Awakens, you know, that sort of thing. And it's, you know, it's a neat little narrative trope to have these newer characters be forced to kind of inspire a revival of belief almost, or purpose in these legacy characters, and for them to then kind of acknowledge that these newer characters have power, and to kind of, you know, hand over the keys to the franchise to them by the end of the film. And sometimes that happens via their death. I mean, we see that happen a lot in these films. But also sometimes it just happens through sort of, you know, saying, yeah, okay, I respect you, you know, I support you, I you know, you are worthy.
It's interesting you mentioned death, and obviously with the Star Wars movies and going right in through Last Jedi now, we're in a position where two characters have been quote-unquote killed off, although we know that Mark Hamill's in the new one, so he's around in some way, shape, or form. And but unfortunately, Carrie Fisher died after Last Jedi was made, but before they started doing any filming for the new film. So they're going to have to deal with her death in some way, shape, or form. So it will be interesting to see how they do that. But as you point out with these legacy films, for example, we couldn't even have a legacy film anymore for Star Trek because so many of the original actors, we had it already, obviously, but the only one that you really could, I mean, I know William Shatner's still around and he still complained that he never got into any of the newer ones, but
Well, I mean, he had his kind of legacy moment in one of the earliest films to follow this model, which is Generations. Yeah, absolutely. But we could bring him up. But, you know, at the same way, like, you know, Jurassic World, the first Jurassic World film, doesn't, I mean, it's got B.D. Wong, but, you know, I think it's stretching credibility to say that he's a major character from the original film.
Most people probably don't even remember he was in the original film.
Exactly, yes. So, I mean, I think that film, I mean, it could have very easily had, I mean, we have Jeff Goldblum in, you know, very briefly in the sequel. We could have had Sam Neill you know, or really, you know, anybody return. But what they seemed to decide to do instead was the park, actually, in Jurassic World, is that they revisit the original park, or they find the original park, and have them sort of need to use the older technology at one point in the film to escape. And so, you know, there's different ways to kind of do this. So yeah, look, it definitely works a lot better, I think. And there's certainly something of an emotional punch about seeing one of these older actors reprising an earlier role, especially a role that made them famous. It's not the only way to do it, but it is, interesting.
Of course, we had to do a reprise in Rogue One in a different way, obviously. Mm. Carrie Fisher was still alive at the time of Rogue One, but they couldn't use her original look. And obviously, Peter Cushing was long gone by this point. And that's using the CGI to recreate. And we've seen it happen again in other films. I noticed in Captain Marvel, the new Marvel film, they did the same thing with Samuel Jackson and Clark Gregg to make them look younger. And I'm still not sold on it. If you're used to these characters and you're used to these actors, to see them look younger, to me at least, it didn't complete it. You were spending more time thinking about, oh, he looks younger. So I don't know. It's interesting that they've made these attempts to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Sean Young in Blade Runner 2049 is another example of that, which is interesting to have, you know, the, you know, very gray-haired Harrison Ford next to a perfectly recreated Sean Young in that film. I mean, it is interesting. And I actually, this is one of my current academic projects, is I've presented a work in progress paper, and I'm writing on this idea of these digital faces, in particularly in franchise cinema, because it does seem to be that this is where these digital faces live, is in these franchise films, which, you know, tells you something about how they operate in terms of memory and in terms of nostalgia, and in terms of the way that I think really a lot of these films, especially as they reach an emotional climax, or perhaps, you know, one or two films into their franchises. I mean, and of course, in the case of the Marvel films, I mean, yes, there's definitely Captain Marvel, but some of the earlier films, I think Ant-Man uses similar technology too in some flashback scenes.
Well, they all, you're right. There's enough flashback scenes. Well, even in the new film, there's flashback scenes that they had to do that, especially with Michael Douglas and a couple other characters.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. And so what I'm kind of arguing is that to some extent, and I do mention this idea in the book as well, these franchise films are sort of, you know, using this technology and using this kind of narrative trope as almost the equivalent of the clip show. So, you know, you'd remember, you know, before we could binge TV series, or before we could, you know, jump on Netflix and pick out our favorite episode of whatever it happened to be that we wanted to see, you know, very, very, very easily. To rewatch a favorite episode of something would be very difficult. And, you know, you'd have to catch it on a rerun, or perhaps you'd have a tape copy, but that's, you know, was still much less likely, especially with really long series.
And older series before, I mean, Star Wars didn't even come out on video for years because there was no such thing at the time.
Yeah.
There was not public video. I mean, people weren't, and Lucas held on to it very tightly. It was a long time before it even came out.
Yeah, which, I mean, surprisingly in a way, is definitely, you know, similar to the Disney vault strategy over the years. But that's a whole other story. But yeah, so, you know, TV series in particular would do a clip show where a clip episode where they'd have sort of, you know, Chandler, don't you remember when Monica said blah, blah, blah? And then, you know, the screen goes wavy and we suddenly see, you know, a sort of 3-minute excerpt of a good scene from a previous episode of Friends. And that was the kind of logic of revisiting the best moments. And so, you know, I think in a way, you know, as a lot of these stories start to wrap up, and you mentioned Marvel before, and I don't want to sort of collaterally spoil that film, but definitely you can see the logic working of in a different way, because I think, you know, directly doing the clip show, people would be irate these days because, you know, it would be sort of some kind of unimaginative reuse of an older film. But you can see that similar logic where they're sort of like, remember this moment. This moment was really good.
And yet Friends is probably one of the most binge shows on Netflix because there was a discussion. They were going to take it off, and everybody went crazy. So it is interesting that a show that had to use clips in order to make it possible to remember is now people. It's impossible to forget.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I am constantly amazed. So with my students, for the last 4 years, I've been teaching every semester, so that's twice a year. So eight times I've taught a big introduction to media studies subject at my uni. And so I'm teaching mostly 18-year-olds starting university for the first time. And I survey them. I send them out a Google form with about 70 TV shows from all eras in there. So, you know, including every possible popular show right at the moment, Australia specific stuff as well. But, you know, Game of Thrones, these big things that you would expect everybody to be watching. And I tell you what, every single semester, the most popular show is Friends, which just perplexes me.
I do remember when it came out, and it, of course it was out at the same time that Seinfeld was coming close to wrapping up. I don't remember the exact dates now, but obviously Seinfeld had become a very much of a water cooler show, and then Friends became another water cooler show, and I think that's probably not a surprise that it is still quite popular.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, certainly the 90s, very much back in a fashion sense. So I often think of Friends as their kind of lookbook for clothing choices. So maybe that plays into.
Well, we all have our nostalgia, as you pointed out. We haven't had a chance to talk about Rebels, which is unfortunate. I mean, that's the animated series. And of course, we know that Lucasfilm is still continuing the animated series. We've already had one season of Resistance, so we know they're going to be continuing with that. But I really wanted to bring up Last Jedi. I know we're running. You know, we've been on for almost an hour, but I don't want to not mention Last Jedi because I think it's worth discussing it. And I know I did not see it when it first came out for a variety of reasons, but I did everything I could not to get any spoilers. I tried my best, but I knew there were controversies about it, and I said, okay, let's wait and see. And I finally saw it. And there are issues I have with the film, including a couple of plot points that weren't even necessary. I mean, there was absolutely no reason for them to go to the main ship to turn off the beacon because they didn't need the beacon. I would love to see, but you had some, what I thought, positive aspects of it. So I'm going to see, where are you on The Last Jedi and its importance to the overall, to the nine films?
Well, I think it's really important film for Disney and for this current era of Star Wars, not even the sequel trilogy, but for the current era, in that and you know, I think one of the fairly obvious and reasonable criticisms of my book is, you know, why didn't you wait until the last the Rise of Skywalker episode 9 and then it could be about this, you know, new trilogy from start to finish? But for me, the book is a snapshot of the revival of Star Wars, which is the first saga film, the first anthology film or Star Wars story film in Rogue One, and the first animated series, which is Rebels. And since then we've seen, you know, as you point out, Resistance, we've seen Solo, and we've seen The Last Jedi. So The Last Jedi is this kind of, I think, a really clear articulation point for this era of Star Wars, in that, you know, it's very clearly signaling that now we're moving from revival to perhaps re-articulation, I think. I don't know if if the right word is revision. I think that's maybe a little bit too strong. I think initially when I saw The Last Jedi, I thought it was revision. It was, you know, really kind of meddling or, you know, getting into the guts of the Star Wars universe and changing things. But now I think it's just altering things a little bit and it's charting a new direction. So I think, you know, it holds a key place for Disney and for the sequel trilogy in that sense. I think in terms of I think just in terms of how I feel about the film myself, I think there are some really beautiful scenes in The Last Jedi. I think, you know, Yoda, I mean, that's one of the best uses of that character post even Empire Strikes Back, but, you know, look, he's pretty good in Return of the Jedi as well. And, you know, they just really, really nailed his return and added to the long list of quotable Yoda quotes, which is no mean feat, I think, in They Are What We Grow... We Are What They Grow Beyond, talking about being a master and reflecting on that. And that's just such a beautiful articulation of, yes, there is a little bit more wisdom that Yoda can impart on Luke and also the world, perhaps. but also, you know, I think visually it's an incredible film, and I think that it does some really interesting and provocative and difficult, but in a good way, things for some of the character archetypes, in that it perhaps does, and this is probably one of the reasons why people had such a strong response to it, is that it does deconstruct and to some extent criticize that sort of reach for the gun first and sort of get by the seat of our pants and make it up as we go along and it'll all be okay sort of mentality. It sort of says maybe that's not sufficient for leading people who are relying on you into the future, which is, that's challenging. That's sort of directly challenging the character type of Han Solo, really. And so I can understand the strong response to it, but I think that's provocative and that's brave, I think, as well. So, you know, but at the same time, I do think that it doesn't nail its comedic moments. I think it kind of waits for the joke to land, which is not like Star Wars. It's kind of like in the original films and in The Force Awakens, the jokes are very much, you sort of realize they're jokes when they've already passed you by, and that's what makes them funny, because they've sort of, you know, the characters have already moved on and you're like, wait, that was really funny. Whereas in The Last Jedi, it's sort of like, you know, there's a bit of a nudge and a wink and like, did you get that? Which I didn't like so much. But yeah, look, it is one that I think I will go back and certainly get a lot from particular key scenes. And I do think that the end for Luke is actually really fitting. If, as you pointed out, we can even call it an end. But, you know, I think a lot of people misunderstood what Luke was about, in that they thought he was this big, bad, Sith-defeating, you know, hyper-powered Jedi, when he wins in The Return of the Jedi by throwing away his lightsaber, by choosing not to fight, by saying that, you know, he believes in his principles and his understanding of other people and the power of other people, and the decisions that other people will make, in this case being, you know, his father. That's his way to chart the future. And so, you know, his end for me in The Last Jedi, of choosing to make himself an icon and a symbol for the resistance by not actually fighting again, I mean, I think that's perfect.
And they clearly brought that up in the final scenes just before the credits, where we see the children on the, you know, the racing children who are playing with a Luke Skywalker doll. So yeah. In that sense, things have not, I mean, we're talking legacy again, because people who grew up during that period, the kids, I mean, Luke Skywalker as a toy is still an incredibly popular toy.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's, I mean, you know, and there is that moment definitely where I think the film is once again, as has been the power of the Disney era, where the film is speaking within the film and the context of the narrative, but it's also speaking to the audience. It's also saying, you know, as Han Solo says, you know, it's true, all of it, you know, it's as true for you as it is in this narrative universe, which is, I think, a really powerful way of putting it.
And I think in the end, it goes back to Lucas and his ways of talking about, you know, the concept of storytelling and the fact that myths are, you know, he's a big fan of Joseph Campbell, obviously, and, and myths as, you know, we all have our myths. And to a large extent, I think he's saying, or what the films prove, is that some of our myths are going to, in the 21st century, are going to come from popular media.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, really, that's one of his great contributions, I think, to popular culture, is that kind of understanding that, well, you know, and coming from his own childhood as well, he often talks about going to see the, you know, the old film serials and getting so much from these old movies and this old kind of, you know, almost simplistic myth making, but, you know, nonetheless really resonates because of that simplicity. And I think, you know, that's, he's contributed so much with Star Wars. Yeah.
And yet in many ways, television these days has become, in many ways, at least in the United States, I don't know how much of United States material you see in Australia on a regular basis, but most TV series anymore have become serials. I mean, from beginning to end, there are very few television shows that you can truthfully say you can watch an episode right in the middle and not and be able to understand everything. Even comedies, you know, half-hour comedies are becoming more and more dependent on past knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and in a way that they never were before. And that sort of, you know, in part goes back to technology, in that there's just no way that you could hope that your audience would possess so much information if you were just broadcasting on a week-by-week basis. You'd have to build in fail-safes and make sure that, you know, your audience was keeping up, whereas now you know that even if they don't catch it at the broadcast date, they're going to go back and watch it on catch up or watch it on streaming, if they're not even doing that in the first place, as most people are, really. So, you know, but
I must admit, I watch Game of Thrones on HBO Now rather than watching it live on HBO because it starts a couple minutes earlier, but also because, you know, I can control it a little bit that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, gosh, Game of Thrones in Australia is a whole nother kettle of fish, because we notoriously have really terrible internet speeds. I think it's the 62nd in the world in Australia. So
you mean the United States isn't bad at something technology related?
Yeah. No, we are not good in terms of that kind of thing. Sadly, there have been a few initiatives to fix that which have been thwarted, but that's a whole nother topic. But yes, it's not amazing. But look, I will say, on the topic of TV, that I think it's very, very interesting that now Lucasfilm has kind of said, okay, you know, after the rise of Skywalker, after episode 9, we're going to cool it a little bit with the films, and we're going to concentrate on The Mandalorian, the TV show that I think is pretty much ready to be released when Disney Plus, the streaming service,
they're holding everything for Disney Plus at this point.
Exactly, yes. And then the Cassian Andor series, the spin-off series from Rogue One, is, I think, in production right now and will be released next year. So it seems like they're pivoting to TV, which, look, it might seem like a very contemporary strategy, but at the same time, look, you know, let's go back to George Lucas, in that after Revenge of the Sith, what was, in his mind, I think at the time, and in most people's minds, the final Star Wars film, he was, you know, his plan was, okay, now we do TV, and not just the animated series, but, you know, he wrote, he had 100 episode scripts written out, ready for a TV series, that a live action TV series that I think parts of that eventually ended up being Rogue One. But, you know, this is actually the George Lucas model. When you're done with the films, you turn to TV and kind of revive that. And so I think, you know, it's very interesting that Lucasfilm is doing that at this point. And, you know, we'll get back to the films, I'm sure, only a couple of years down the track. But, yeah, it's George Lucas is mocked for saying, you know, that line in the Phantom Menace making of documentary where he says it's like poetry, it all rhymes. But, you know, it does.
Well, in Clone Wars, he already had started it, even though it was animated. Clone Wars was number one. It's considered considered part of canon, but it was purposely put in there for TV, sort of to bridge the two movies. So he actually started it even before. Now we see contemporary Lucasfilm continuing with it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, those animated series have become a major prong. I mean, I know that we're probably out of time.
We can continue to talk. I just had one other question. I need to know this because it's something that I'm interested in. Would you ever, first off, I think it's highly unlikely we'll ever see them, but wouldn't you want to read Lucas's treatments for 7 through 9?
Yes, I would really, really like to read them, especially because... You know, he was so vocally critical of The Force Awakens when it first appeared. You know, he did that Charlie Rose interview where he said, Disney didn't want to do my script. They wanted to do a retro movie, is how he put it. So, that's how I start the book, is sort of, well, you know, people say that The Force Awakens is just an unimaginative remake of A New Hope, but Lucas can see how things have changed. So, you know, maybe we should, you know, if he can see, then maybe we should take a harder look at what, you know, what's different from how George Lucas would have done things. And so I think that would be such a fascinating comparison to make. Yeah.
And by the way, the prequels have quite a bit to fall back on. We have, once again, three main characters in the first film, or four actually now, because, you know, with Jake Lloyd. But I mean, it still comes down to the same thing. In every first episode of the trilogy, some major character who's important to everyone dies. So yeah. Let's go back to Lucas's original point, which I think he said I heard this recently. He said there's only 32 plots, or he doesn't say that. He's quoting someone else. So let's not pretend like what he was going to do for 7 through 9 was going to be that different.
No, exactly. And, you know, I kind of wonder, because especially the first Star Wars film was such an amalgamation of his own media diet, from, you know, those serials that I mentioned before to Westerns and Akira Kurosawa films. You know, maybe he's just finally getting a taste of his own medicine, where he knows what it feels like to see, you know, a film so heavily inspired by his own work rather than the other way around.
And frankly, since his last film's likely going to that he had any control over was going to end up being Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, I don't think he's got, you know, let's back off a little bit from that, George. You know.
Yeah.
So anyway, we've gone longer than I usually do, and I really appreciate your time, but we could probably talk for a lot longer. But I think at this point, people would be saying, okay, fine, I get your point. Read the book.
Yeah.
So the book, Star Wars After Lucas, A Critical Guide to the Future of the Galaxy by Dan Golding. First off, the fact that it's University of Minnesota Press, I think, is great. The idea that a university press feels like this is an important book to publish is a great thing to me. I mean, it just shows the ability of the press, you know, that we as writers now have the ability to be considered on an academic level for some popular culture is just such a great thing.
Absolutely. And look, I will 100% say the University of Minnesota Press have been just so fantastic from start to finish. And, you know, look, some academic books never see, you know, the light of day in a non-academic context. And sometimes that's even as simple as they cost a lot of money. Sometimes these books, they can be more than $100. But, you know, they always saw this book as something that people who were not tenured would have an interest in. So
yeah, and they priced it very well. I mean, there's no question. In the United States, the Kindle version's less than $15. So I mean, and even the hardcover's not that expensive. So this is an unusual book in some ways for academic presses. So I'm glad, number one, that you wrote it, but also hopefully it will continue to get lots of good press and people buying it, so that
we can continue with these kind of projects that are going to reach more than the quote-unquote academics.
Yeah, I really hope so too, yeah.
Well, thank you for your time. Like I said before, we went for an hour and 15 minutes, and I don't think I'm going to edit hardly anything. So it was a long discussion, but I think it was important to get your sense of the whole thing and not just the more current period. And as we approach the end of the year and Rise of Skywalker, hopefully we will continue to enjoy what Lucasfilm is doing with Star Wars, and whatever it ends up being, that Star Wars will be around in some way, shape, or form, as long as Disney, yeah, as long as Disney is, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. No, thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me, and for, gosh, for, you know, having read the book and taken an interest in it and being so, you know, prepared and interested for this interview. It's been a real pleasure chatting to you.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Thanks to Dan again for talking to me. As I mentioned during the interview, this book is definitely geared to both an academic and popular audience. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network.